And you're very welcome to another edition of Majority World. I'm Robbie Sinnott and hope you can join us for the next hour of social justice, global issues and matters multicultural. And on today's programme we're going to be speaking to Emilio about trials of people in Madrid, and it's free press is at stake here, and that'll be going on at around 10 to 5. And then we'll be speaking to Barry Finnegan about the European Social Forum, about neoliberalism in Europe and alternatives to that. First of all, though, I'm going to play one of the recordings when I was over in Binghamton, New York State, back in September. And this was the trial of the St. Patrick's Four, who spilt their blood in a US recruiting station to protest against the illegal war. Now, we have our own Pit Stop Plowshares, who took an action against a US plane down in Shannon Airport, and their trial is coming up in July, again here in Ireland. But these people in the States called the St. Patrick's Four, they actually recently got sentenced for not major, they were only misdemeanours they eventually got convicted of, and their sentences between 3 and 7 months came out last week. So this is a woman speaking from her name is Media Benjamin, and I'll actually let somebody else do the intro as well, the guy who's actually doing the compare tonight, because he can say far more about her than I possibly could.
Our next speaker is someone whom I just met, Media Benjamin. I'll read what she is. I'll read what we have here on the website. I'm certainly impressed, and I'm really glad to meet her. Media Benjamin, a powerful and charismatic force in human rights activism, has struggled for social justice in Asia, Africa, and the Americas for over 20 years. She is the founding director of the human rights organization Global Watch. She is also the co-founder of Code Pink, Women for Peace. You know, Code Pink, because we don't want the USA. That color code that the government wants us to use, and also a group that they've recently formed, the Occupation Watch, which is in Baghdad now. In February of 2003, Media Benjamin visited Iraq and met with weapons inspectors, women's groups, and ordinary Iraqi citizens. And actually, she's been there 4 times, she tells me. She's also been involved with civil disobedience at the Democratic and Republican National Convention. She also has a book that she wants to share with us called Stop the Next War. A very dynamic and wonderful speaker and a wonderful woman that I'm very pleased to present to you, Media Benjamin. Thank you.
Well, first let me say what an honor it is to be here and being able to go into that courtroom today and seeing the grace and the presence and the just aura of the kind of values that the people who are there speaking for us generated throughout the courtroom was really beautiful to see and
helps to renew my faith in the American people. And being on this wonderful panel is a great honor as well. I was in Iraq before the war began, and I was there once with Kathy, with Cynthia, who's seated right here. And I was in Iraq at the time that Colin Powell made his speech before the United Nations, giving the evidence for going to war. And I remember being in a room full of journalists, and the journalists were laughing as he was giving his speech, saying, "We've been there, there's no weapons there. We've been there, there's no weapons there." And after the speech was over, they came over to us as Americans. They said, "There's no way the U.S. is going to go to war with that flimsy evidence." And the next day is when George Bush got on national TV and said, "The game is over." And the Iraqis knew that war was about to start and had no way to protect themselves from what was to come. And we felt hopeless, we felt powerless, and one of the things we symbolically thought of doing was doing a blood donation in Iraq, and we organized it with the Red Cross at one of the oil refineries outside of Baghdad, where Iraqi women and U.S. women came to give our blood, and it was a symbolic act to say that we did not believe in blood for oil, we did not believe in blood for empire, for conquest, for corporate greed. We believed in blood for uniting the human family, blood for life-affirming activities. And little did we know, just a few weeks later, the St. Patrick's Four would be spilling their blood at an Army recruiting station with that beautiful message, as we heard so eloquently in their opening statements today, to say that what unites us is blood, and that that blood can and must be used for positive things, for healing, for loving, for showing compassion. And that, of course, is the essence of what this trial is all about. Do we as a people believe in using our blood for killing, for hate, for conquest, for empire? Or do we believe in using our blood for healing this planet and showing how much we love the other human beings on this planet? I must admit, as much as I was against the war to begin with, there was a little piece of me that said, these sanctions have been so horrific for the Iraqi people. Saddam Hussein is such an evil dictator. Maybe something good could come of this for the Iraqi people. Maybe when the sanctions are lifted, their lives might get better. And little did I know how horrible things would get. I really had no idea that even the basics like the infrastructure would be worse today than we were before we invaded when those sanctions were in place. And you look today and you see Iraqis not having electricity, not having clean drinking water, not having a decent communication system, raw sewage out in front of their houses. And I remember going to what was the ministry that took care of the water system and meeting all these very bright young engineers. And they were sitting around just talking. And we said, well, why aren't you working? They said, we're not allowed to work because the contracts for rebuilding are all going to U.S. companies. They're going to Halliburton, they're going to Bechtel, and we are not allowed to work on them. And they are bringing engineers in from other countries who know nothing about our system, who don't even know how to rebuild. And somebody said, of our delegation said, it must be boring just to sit around all day and not have any work to do. And one of the young men said, it's not boring, it's painful. And when we asked him why it was painful, he said, because it's our children that are being killed, because they don't have clean drinking water. And when they drink the dirty drinking water, they get diarrhea, and we take them to the hospitals, and the hospitals have nothing, and they are dying. And that's why we see in the UNICEF report that didn't even bother to make the mainstream news in this press how since our invasion, the rate of severe malnutrition in Iraq has doubled. And of course, it's painful for the people who want to be rebuilding their country and see their own resources, as well as our tax dollars, going to war profiteering companies that are gaining their profits from a war and their close ties to the administration that went into this war on the basis of lies to begin with. Imagine how it makes the Iraqi people feel. And talking about how do the Iraqi people feel, we're going to see today, right after this, some footage from Fallujah, where the Bush administration, after the November election, said that it had a mandate for this war and went in and conducted an all-out assault on a town of 300,000 Sunnis by bringing in the Kurds and bringing in the Shiites to kill their brother and sister Sunnis. And we will see how the people were left refugees in their own land, similar to how people were left refugees in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, with no water, with no food, in the baking sun. But we don't have to go back to November of last year, because it is happening right now. And right now, it's happening in the town of Tal Afar, right near the Syrian border, where the U.S. has again called in the Shiites and the Kurds to kill their brother and sister Sunnis in a town of 200,000 people, 70% of them Sunnis. And in retaliation for the killing of the Sunnis, we saw the bloodiest day since the war began in Baghdad. just last week with 160 people being killed. And so the U.S. government in all its gall comes in and says, well, that's all the more reason we have to stay there, because look at all this bloodshed and retaliation. What twisted logic that is. Because it is precisely the U.S. policy since it got into Iraq to be exacerbating the ethnic tensions that has been sowing the seeds of civil war. And the sooner the U.S. gets out, the more possibilities the Iraqis will have to heal their beleaguered country. It is quite amazing to see that despite the propaganda of the Bush administration, despite the disastrous media that has echoed the propaganda of the Bush administration, the American people now, after 2 years of this terrible invasion, have decided that those of us in this room that said, please don't invade Iraq to begin with, those of us who have been protesting since the U.S. invaded Iraq and continue to do it, now we represent the majority of the American people. So, Teresa, and Claire and Danny and Peter, sitting in that courtroom, are certainly not isolated, certainly not a minority, certainly not fringe. They now represent the sentiment of this country. The American people are now saying in their majority, we should never have gotten into the war to begin with, that this war is an unwinnable war, that we are no safer at home because we are fighting over there. And just this last week in the latest New York Times CBS poll, for the first time since the war began, we now have 52% of the American people saying that we should get out of Iraq as soon as possible. But there is something the American people don't know because the media won't tell them. And it is fascinating how the media found its voice during Hurricane Katrina and started to criticize this administration. I only wish it would find its voice in the case of Iraq. Because what the media still refuses to tell us is that there is a massive nonviolent resistance movement in Iraq to the U.S. occupation as well. And there are many ways that you can gauge that. What the media did not tell us is when Iraqis risked their lives in January to vote, that the majority of them voted for a coalition that had as its number two position to call for a withdrawal of the foreign occupation forces. What the media refused to tell us is that there was a poll taken 2 days before the Iraqi elections that found not only the majority of the Sunnis, who were favored by Saddam Hussein, 82%, but also a majority of the Shiites, the most oppressed by Saddam Hussein, 69% of them said they wanted the U.S. troops to either leave immediately or as soon as an Iraqi government was formed. What the media hasn't told us is that just 2 months ago, there was a petition passed around in Iraq, and within the course of 3 weeks, 1 million Iraqis signed on to a petition calling for the withdrawal of the occupation forces. What the media hasn't told us is that the 275 people who were elected to the National Council, these are people who agreed to participate in an election supervised by the occupation forces themselves, that a third of them came out with a letter and said, we want the occupation forces to leave. And what the media hasn't told us is something that happened just this week, where there was a commission that was formed by this National Assembly, a 14-person National Sovereignty Commission formed exclusively by Shiites and Kurds that came out unanimously and said that the only way that Iraq could be a sovereign country is if there were a withdrawal of the occupation forces, that there were going to go to the United Nations and ask them to declare Iraq a sovereign country, and they were going to ask the U.S. for a timetable to withdraw U.S. troops. Why don't we hear about that in the media? So we have the U.S. people saying end the occupation. We have the Iraqi people saying end the occupation. And we have always had with us the majority of the world community saying end the occupation. We saw that in all its glory on February 15, 2002, before the war began, when we had millions of people for the first time ever in history before a war saying the world says no to war. The Bush administration called us a focus group and refused to listen. And now we also have an example of democracy in countries throughout the world that the Bush administration has not acknowledged, and either has the U.S. press, which is within the coalition that Bush called the coalition of the willing to invade Iraq. We always called the coalition of the coerced, and now we can call it the coalition of the disappeared, because the vast majority of countries that were strong-armed to go into this war have now had a people's revolution within their countries where their people have demanded that they leave Iraq. So we are part of a massive global coalition that understands that war is not the answer, that we need to use nonviolent ways to resolve conflicts, that we need to build up international institutions and international treaties, from the Kyoto Protocols to the Non-Proliferation Treaty to the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, that we have to disarm if we expect the rest of the world to disarm. And that we desperately need institutions like the International Criminal Court, where people like Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, and yes, George Bush should be tried.
That was Medea Benjamin, one of the founders of Code Pink. Now, this Saturday coming at 1 p.m, this is a Saturday the 21st of February, at 1 p.m. outside the Spanish Embassy, the Irish Basque Committees are holding a demonstration, and it's to do with something called the 1898. It doesn't necessarily refer to a year, maybe it does, but it refers to events that began in 1998, which are seen as being an attack on some of the cultural, social and political freedoms, and on civil rights indeed, of the legitimacy of the very Basque identity. And here to speak to me a little bit more about it and to fill us in a little bit is Emilio. And Emilio, in what way, for instance, does it bear on the human rights?
Well, this court case is called 1898, and it was originated, you know, like when the first action against what is called like the Basque movement was done by one of the Spanish court of the Internacional, and from there it takes the name because it's a very extensive summary. Now, we think it's a direct attack, not just in human rights as an individual, also in humans, you know, the right to association. Like, I mean, it's a direct attack to political parties that have been established in the Basque country for the last 30 years, trade unions, newspapers that they were created from the 80s and they were closed in 1998, and also new institutions that were created, you know, to try to achieve, you know, like a self-determination right for the Basque country, and create, you know, cross-fronters institutions like Udalbiche.
So the newspaper Egun, for instance, was banned in 1998, and there's an attempt by the Spanish government to delegitimize dissent. Anybody who believes in Basque secessionism, to bar them from having any participation in discourse.
Well, I think everything started like in 1998 when the Partido Popular, I think we have to put it in context, the Partido Popular was in the Spanish government, and repression, you know, against the Basque political parties and organization was highly increased. And it is like, I mean, this summary and this all this whole case basically attacked anything that he, you know, put in doubt the status quo of the Spanish state at itself. So anybody or any organizations then dare to claim, you know, that we as the Basque have a right for to claim self-determination and to, you know, like to move forward, try to, you know, extend our culture and our or our identity, you know, like we are banned and that is, you know, more or less, you know, forbidden, you know.
So it's like it's illegal to hold a point of view almost.
Well, basically, it's not like illegal, you know, to call yourself like, like, I mean, they say, you know, like we are out or this law, you are out of the law because if you believe the Basque country and you call publicly for independence of self-determination, you align yourself with ETA strategies. And because you align yourself, they are entitled to act legally against you. And now this whole thing it was created, you know, to try to, you know, what they call to try to annihilate all the satellites, you know, like groups that support ETA. Now, this case went beyond that. Like, I mean, the Spanish government, what it's done, anybody really, like, I mean, anybody that he dare to say, you know, like, here, we don't want to be Spanish, we want to go through an independent process. Anybody who dares to say something like that, it is considered to be a terrorist. And that's the question. I mean, they have crossed the line between what is ETA as an organization and, you know, public organizations and political parties and social movements that have been working in the Basque country for years. So anybody who claims, you know, they want the independence, you know, they have acted against that.
So the law has been used for political motives, you're saying. But also, I think José María Aznar has this strategy, in my opinion anyway, of trying to mobilise popular Spanish or Castilian support against anybody who would say that they're not Spanish. On the back of the Basque campaign, he organised million-man marches in Madrid, for instance, which are used subtly to try to drum up support for Partido Popular, the conservative party in Spain.
Yeah, like that's quite a correct point of view. I think the strategy it has been and it is, you know, like to use anything related to any kind of nationalism, you know, within the Spanish state, you know, to present it to the Spanish public as a direct attack to the future of Spain. And you can see it every day. You can see it in the TV, and you know, even when the 11th, you know, March, the bombs in the trains in Madrid happened, you know, like even the Basque was blamed of that. Like, I mean, the Partido Popular knew, because of the situation back, you know, in 1988 and the last few years, anything related to terrorism, you know, could gain votes. And they used that opportunity, you know, to try to attack as much as they can to the Basque nationalists.
So people might draw parallels, for instance, to Britain, where there's anti-terrorism legislation proposed at the moment, which would deny certain freedoms of speech, and perhaps to the US, where terrorism was used to get people elected into government as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we can't forget, like, I mean, with the Partido Popular, with it now, was in pure alliance with the US and the way, you know, like, and Britain, the way they got together, you know, in the sense, like, the war with Iraq, for example. Like, I mean, it is designed to try to silence any voice that it questions, you know, the existence of Spain that it is at the moment.
They actually agreed to participate in the Iraqi war, despite 90% disapproval by the Spanish people.
Yeah, like, I mean, I wouldn't have exactly figures of, but yeah, like, I mean, it was highly, you know, rejected in Spain, the participation of the Spanish army within the war in Iraq. Now,
they called it the Coalition of the Willing, which is unusual. And saying this now, there's a new regime there now, the Zapatero regime, which is our government, which is a socialist government. And have things changed towards the Basque country? Has the attitude changed?
Well, like, I mean, I think, when the Partido Popular left the government, I mean, it was a new breeze, you know, I mean, new air in the political arena, and everybody just hoping, you know, things will change. Now, it has changed. I mean, Zapatero obviously is a person with a different profile than Aznar, and it tends to be more throughout to dialogue with other parties. Now, in regard to the Basque Country, I mean, the situation hasn't even changed much. Like, I mean, we have heard on the radio and the news that Zapatero is, you know, promising the end or the beginning of the end of ETA. But, I mean, even, like, I mean, what are the ministers saying? You know, in the last year, the Socialist government on the last couple of years has arrested more than 200 people in the Basque Country related to accusations of being members of ETA or activities regarding ETA. Mm-hmm. Now, this court case, like, I mean, that obviously is a political case, is being supported by the Spanish government at the moment, and they have to go ahead, and it's happening at the moment. Batasuna and other political parties are still banned, and I mean, nothing has really changed. And I mean, it's very important, you know, at the moment when we're trying to define, you know, what we want for the in terms of the peace process, you know, like they move forward, you know, and they clearly, you know, define, you know, what they're wanting to do. And I think one of the Basque politicians that has been banned at the moment, he was saying, you know, I think it's time for all to discuss the real issues regarding the peace process. I mean, it's the right for self-determination in the Basque Country.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, definitely things have to be negotiated and things have to be discussed. It's better than trying to ban things. And I suppose the Socialist Party had a history of shoot to kill and of torture as well of Basque suspects, and as well throughout the González regime. And I suppose as well as that, there's so many different places that you could speak about, like the Catalonia. The right-wing Partit Popular actually showed their power when it came to Catalan looking for extra autonomy as well, and one military commander was sacked because he threatened a Spanish army intervention, which shows things haven't come too far since Franco's days in Spain anyway. But Emilio, I'm afraid we sort of have to leave it here. We just remind people that it's 1 o'clock anyway, on Saturday, yeah, outside the Spanish embassy, and you can get the 17 bus there. And goes to Ballsbridge anyway, so hopefully you get a good turnout anyway. And next time we'll have somebody, a spokesman from the Spanish Embassy. We just done a very short notice, but thank you very much for coming on, and it's fantastic. And
this is Near FM 101.6, community radio as it should be.
And I'm Robbie Sinnott, and this is Majority World. And if you'd like to text us, the number is 087-69-44-500. I should have given that at the beginning of the programme, but here it is again, 087-69-44-500. And it's always great to hear any messages, critical or supportive. It's fantastic. This shows that you're listening out there, and it's great feedback. And on the line at the moment, we've got Barry Finnegan, and Barry's going to talk to us about, well, the European Services Directive, European Social Forum, and alternatives to the neoliberal agenda in Europe. Mm-hmm. But I suppose, where do we start?
Robbie.
How are you going there, Barry? There is an agenda, you think, in Europe anyway, the neoliberal agenda, and this is about privatisation and less democracy.
Tell it like it is, Robbie. That's exactly what it is. And today's a black day for democracy, and it's a bad day for consumer protection, and it's a bad day for social and health policy right across Europe. The European Parliament just this very day has voted to accept the Bolkestein Directive on services, which means that no longer will our democratically elected governments be able to use the terms consumer protection or social policy as excuses to control the behaviour and activities of international capitalist enterprises. This is a huge blow to the democratic gains that we've won over the last couple of hundred years.
Yes, so some people say we live in a society, but some even say we live in a market, but this is not even about marketism. It's about when you get into multinationals and they buy up things. I mean, it's about just undemocratic control, is it?
Well, you know, there's a clatter of politicians, business people, think tanks, academics, researchers, and multi-billionaires across the world in the early 1970s just decided that there was too much democracy in the world, and what was happening was profit rates were falling, and since then there's been an attack on the social welfare state, and there's been an attack on the right of the people of the world to elect their own governments to control the activities of private companies.
So and
this services directive is yet another nail in the coffin of that of the social democratic gains that were won after the Second World War.
I suppose I should say that we actually invited somebody from Fianna Fáil. First of all, we invited Owen Ryan MEP on to speak last week. Then we invited the Fianna Fáil party to come up with anybody. last week. In fairness, that was short notice and they couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And then we invited anybody from Fine Gael. We gave them 2 days, no chance on that.
Yeah.
We also, and I actually rang the office of the Fine Gael MEP for Dublin, Gay Mitchell. No go on that as well, even though there was initial enthusiasm. Noel Tracy said he could come on today, but except today, he's up in Ulster at a conference. And I do believe that was a genuine response from Noel Tracy. So
sure.
We might try to get him again, but it doesn't do much for the impact that Europe is out of touch and people can't communicate their feelings with it.
Europe's out of touch, Robbie. The politicians are out of touch. Should the politicians in the Dáil haven't got a bloody clue what's going on? There's like only 65% before the 10 new countries joined, right? Only 80% of all European legislation was translated into the 15 languages. The true figures haven't been released as to how much of the new legislation is translated into the 25 languages, but initial reports are showing that it's only 65%. So what you're talking about is that, now granted, we can read the English version, so there's, you know, it's not absolutely essential to turn it into Irish, although it would be nice, you know, not that the Irish government would be too insistent on that. But you have countries in Europe where the parliamentarians don't have a version of European legislation in their own language. They're like, in relation to these complex trade negotiations and complex technical directives coming from Europe, you know, you take your average Fianna Fáil down the country or even from Dublin politician, you know, they're not connected to the day-to-day workings of what's happening in Europe, and you can't expect the people to be either.
Do you think that on a daily basis they hear more from the 70,000 lobbyists who are located in Brussels and Strasbourg than they do from there?
If anyone's interested to know how grotesque the access that the lobbyists have, there's an excellent group called the Corporate Europe Observatory at CEO.org, Corporate Europe Observatory, and on their website you can download a map, and you can go around Brussels on the map seeing the offices of the lobby groups and the corporate think tanks that, quite frankly, write their policy documents, and the European Commission, quite barefaced, to be honest, cut and paste these think tanks and right-wing lobbyist documents into European Union policy, throw it in front of the European Parliament. Yet again, we saw the right-wing parties and the so-called socialist party of the European Parliament buckle under the pressure from the corporations.
And we couldn't even get them to come on community radio to discuss stuff.
If you're talking about something as technical and detailed as the Services Directive, to be honest, you know, it's very hard. I mean, for example, as a result of this Services Directive, what it's doing is, up till now, since 97, there's been absolute free trade in manufactured goods inside the European Union, right? And the European Union has been allowed to negotiate on our behalf over the heads of the government at a WTO world level. They'll now be able to do that with services.
This is Tony Joyce in the Department of Enterprise, who's
Article
133 committee. He's allowed to sign away anything that the government owns in Ireland, any social public service, and he can...
Essentially, yes. So suppose you have... you know, a group of people in Finglas or a group of people in Crumlin or whatever, and they're getting a few bob off the local government here in Dublin to maybe help do meals on wheels to the old people in the area. Or you have community care nurses that call in to physically handicapped people or something like that. It will now, since the European Parliament today, it'll be illegal for the Irish government and for Dublin City Council not to offer that contract out for tender to the public sector. So any company from anywhere in the world will be able to bid for the contract. It'll be illegal for Dublin Council or for the Irish government to insist on quality control measures. The only criteria they'll be allowed to take into consideration is who submitted the cheapest tender. So for stuff like care for the environment, respect for the elderly, gender equality between men and women, equal access to consumer protection and for people like in travellers, for example, Irish legislation insisting on equality and things like that. The government the ability to take into consideration, well, is this company involved in slave labour or bonded labour out in Africa or something like that? Is this company going to flout local planning authority law? All that will be illegal to take into consideration, and the only criteria that will be allowed to be used is who's submitting the cheapest tender and who can do it the cheapest.
So it's going to cause huge resentment all throughout Europe. The European project itself has been undermined. And now myself and you know, people like me that have a huge in the campaign against the EU constitution, a huge problem with neoliberalism, and a lot of us would be more or less in favour of the idea of a European Union. But this is going to ruin people's faith, that any faith that they have left in the project.
Now, Kathleen Lynch and two other lecturers and professors in social studies at UCD have recently said that market doesn't work in the, quote, care industry.
No. I mean, you go and look on, people have access to the web. I did some research myself there recently. And you have the entire thing that it's called a social platform. And it's literally thousands of non-governmental organisations and civil society groups providing care and services to disadvantaged people throughout the European Union. Homeless, drug addicts, the elderly, the infirm, the long-term unemployed. And every single one of these groups has been very vocal in insisting that social policy and healthcare services be excluded from this draconian legislation that was passed today.
And voluntary groups and charities are all well and good, but they're not accountable. Not as accountable as if a state was providing a service.
Not as accountable. But, like, even, you know, even there's a crowd called the European Liaison Committee for Social Housing, and it's a non-profit group, right, which it's not like a lot of NGOs or whatever. But this crowd provide literally hundreds of thousands of places for homeless people. And they're basically saying, look, in future, it'll be illegal for the government or the county council or the city council to force us to implement a high quality of service. It'll be illegal for them to insist that we carry on from year to year to year. And they were objecting to the fact that it was going to be illegal for the governments to control and regulate them. You know, they want to be regulated. And now it's going to be illegal for the... So someone, private sector company, is going to come in, undercut this Liaison Committee for Social Housing, provide a cheaper service, a cheaper, nastier service at a lower quality. Like, people know, like, for example, you're providing services to people with disabilities, be it whatever physical, say, disability people have. And everybody knows that if you are physically disabled in any way, you're not being sold a normal product in a normal shop in a normal circumstance. You don't have the same power as a consumer as somebody that's able-bodied walking in to buy a stereo or a plastic mug, right? You're maybe housebound, in which case whoever comes to your house to provide the service, you must accept it. And what the idea of having a government is that the government is there to improve the quality of life of the people. And now what the European Parliament has done, under huge pressure, it has to be said, from the unelected, non-democratically accountable Commission and the corporations, is to buckle under the weight and say, no, we don't want the right to regulate the services industry. We want the private sector, in a rampant capitalist fashion, with no guarantees of quality of provision or of service, to do what the hell they like. And they say that they're doing this in the name of the people to generate jobs. What sort of jobs are these going to be? They're going to be 7.50 if we're lucky an hour, 7.65 an hour jobs if we're lucky. And it remains to be seen as well whether or not the Irish government is going to insist on 7.65 an hour being paid to people. It'll all be decided in the run of the mill in the next couple of years at the European Court of Justice, which a lot of us don't have a lot of faith in.
That's right, and subcontracts as well.
Oh, subcontract left, right and centre. I tell you, every single person today listening to this show that has friends or families working in the healthcare industry or in any civil service job in this country, whether it's health or education, better be watching their back for their jobs and their pay and conditions.
Or building or anything.
Or building or any service, any service.
So if anybody pays any money for whatsoever, even, for instance, the library system, for instance...
Privatise it. And don't put in a ramp either for the person in the wheelchair. Oh, God, no. And don't put in braille books for people that are hard of sight. Oh, no. That might cost extra money. And you're only the local government. You have no right to insist on what kind of a service we'll provide. Oh, privatise the lot, Robbie. That's
the
whole plan.
Short-term thinking, because long-term, for instance, if people provided a good public transport, it'd be less traffic and it'd be great, but the short-term takes over all
the
time.
Well, I tell you what, Robbie, if these boys keep it this crack, there's going to be a revolution across Europe in the next 5 or 10 years, because there's no way the people of Europe are going to say goodbye to the social gains that we've battled like hell to win for the last 50 years.
It's strange that the person, actually, Tony Joyce, is given the responsibility of negotiating or what to sign away. He's completely unelected. He's a civil servant, top civil servant.
The man's doing his job. You know what I mean? Like, okay, fair enough, whatever individual morals an individual has, but he can't go outside the remit that Fianna Fáil and the PDs give.
Yeah, but the fact that he's been given this remit is incredible. It's signing away democracy. It's signing away accountability.
Tony is more than willing to go and talk to people about it and explain to them what he's told to do, but he's only able to do his job.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And in a democracy, in fairness now to the man...
we'll try to get him on, actually.
Well, yeah, I mean, and as far as I know... I mean, people in our group and similar groups have debated with him in public before, and Oxfam and Kolov and that have been in touch with, you know, with him a lot. And to be honest, he knows an awful lot more about it than any politician or MEP, I'll tell you that.
Now, we don't have too much time. Can you tell us about the European Social Forum, which is sort of a parallel or something that might be even more democratic than, potentially anyway, than what we have now?
Well, I'll tell you, the European Social Forum is basically one angle on the people's response to this cut back in qualities of public service and the warmongering and sale of torture equipment to places like China and the arms industry and war and poverty and exclusion and our chemical pharmaceutical firms, you know, watching millions die across Africa because they insist on getting their full patent protection, you know. This whole, all this panoply of imperialism, war, neoliberalism, people put their arms up and say, there's nothing I can do. Well, one thing that people can do is hook into this global social forum movement. Now, it's not the be-all and end-all, and it's not necessarily going to provide absolute answers, but what happens is that the social forum event is all the different people, trade unions, women's groups, disability groups, environmentalists, all get together and basically have conversations about what are the problems, be it housing, aid, world debt, water, privatisation, transport, whatever it is. People get together and meet people from across Europe or across the world and try to hammer out what is the problem. And hammer out solutions. So
but the solutions aren't rocket science, are they? The solutions are fairly straightforward. I mean, when people start destroying what we already have, for instance, it's not a good start. But can you tell us just quickly what's going to be happening this weekend?
Is yet another one of these manifestations of people trying to get up and go like, well, look, we can't leave it up to these politicians to provide answers, and we certainly can't leave it to the corporations. And what we've got going is a conference called Ireland in Europe, Alternatives to Neoliberalism Conference. And we have speakers coming over from France, Britain and Holland. The French speaker, Susan George, she's written 12 books. She's quite famous over there. And she writes about women's issues, environmentalism, and particularly how the world is changing and how the economy is changing, and very simple, straightforward solutions. And it explains in very straightforward language, more so than I can, I'll tell you. And she was hugely involved in convincing the French people to vote no to the constitution. And there's a pile of Irish speakers from Kolov, AFRI, PANA, FASTA, lots of environment, anti-military, anti-US imperialism, and trade union groups will be sending representatives and speakers. We've got one of the sessions is chaired by Senator David Norris. Another one of the sessions is chaired by the president of SIPTU, Jack O'Connor. And it's going to be a great day. It's on from 10 till 4 in Liberty Hall. And it's €3 for students and the unemployed and anyone having financial difficulties. And anyone that can afford it and is working, it's a tenner in. And if anyone's looking for further information, they can contact us on 087 230 833-0. And so it's going to be a good day out, and lots of people that are trying from different ways to do their bit to make the world a better place.
I'd wonder, Jack O'Connor, that you mentioned him, and what's the point in the whole participation in the economic partnership negotiations that's going on now if they're not going to mean very much?
Well, the thing is, better in the tent pissing out, Robbie. You know, in fairness, we asked him a good while ago now to chair one of the sessions, and he said he was more than willing. And in fairness, SIPTU have been very good at educating the workers and doing their bit to show the implications of the Services Directive. It's just an awful pity that the Social Democrats and the so-called socialists and the right-wing parties in the European Parliament have basically, in a way, rejected half of the trade union lobby and accepted another half. And it was one issue. Now, the Services Directive is fairly obscure technical stuff to do with the European Union, and there was a good couple of thousand Irish trade unionists now that were fairly well informed about what was going on. Obviously, people in the trade union movement have their own issues with Jack, and you know, at a pan-European level, I'm sure we can, and at an Irish level, we can bring some of them issues out on Saturday. But he'll be there in his capacity as president, and he'll be chairing one of the sessions to do with the ongoing privatisation.
Anyway, I think we've got to brace ourselves, so it's a time about looking together rather than against each other. Anyway,
well, there's no doubt about that, Robbie. Yeah. There's no point in, like, you know, the days of the splits and the splinter splits on the left is over. You know, we have to take our inspiration from the South Americans who are showing how it should be done. You know.
Okay. Well, Barry Finnegan, thanks very much for speaking to us. And
thanks very much, Robbie.
Brilliant.
Bye.
That was The Melting Pot, and that was a group from West Limerick, and I got them on West Limerick Community Radio, and Irish immigrants and Irish people and Scottish people and from people from all over the world. And that particular song was from Somali and sung by a Somalian indeed, and whose name escapes me. And I think the next piece of music we have from comes from that as well, and it's Guy from Kurdistan. It's a piece of fiddle music. Thank you.
los negros del Congo, hablan los negros del Congo, contestan los de Tumán, contestan los de Tumán, alan durun durun durunda, alan durun durun durunda. Hablan los negros del Congo, hablan los negros del Congo, contestan los de Tumán, contestan los de Tumán, alan durun durun durunda, alan durun durun durunda. Los de Salamanca dicen, los de Lambaye que dicen, ensaña cómo estarán, ensaña cómo estarán, alan durun durun durunda, alan durun durun durunda. ¿De dónde vienes? Vienes. ¿De dónde vienes? Hola. Y vengo de la laguna y de Segar, totora de Segar, ahora de Segar, totora de Segar, ahora de Segar, totora de Segar y ahora.
And that's it for Majority World. You did hear Barry Finnegan, and you heard Emilio, and you heard Medea Benjamin. So I've been Robbie Sinnott, and this programme originally goes out between 4:30 and 5:30 on a Thursday. You can hear it again between 9 and 10 on a Friday morning. About social justice, global issues, and anything multicultural. If you want to get in contact with us, it's majorityworld@nearfm.ie, or you can contact me at robbiesin, that's S-I-N, at gmail.com. And definitely, it's great to hear from you, of course. Thanks very much to John Doyle on desk. From myself, Robbie Sinnott, have a good one.
Community Radio for Northeast Dublin, Near FM 101.6.